From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to a special edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, your host for this important discussion on the heartbreak and aftermath of the April 14, 2014 kidnapping of 276 students from a girls' school in Chibok, a small town in Borno State, northeastern Nigeria. The schoolgirls were abducted during the night by the terrorist group Boko Haram and other gunmen from their dormitory as they were sleeping. Over time, some of the girls escaped captivity on their own, while others were later released following intense campaigning efforts by civil society organizations and negotiations by the government. However, over 90 girls still remain in captivity, and there have been subsequent abductions since 2014. Girls have continued to be raped, forced into marriages, and even killed in northern Nigeria. Joining me to discuss the effects of these ongoing traumatic incidents, the effect on the girls and their families, and what is being done to help rehabilitate the young women is Dr. Aisha Muhammad Oyebode. She is the CEO of Murtala Muhammad Foundation, a Lagos, Nigeria-based non-governmental political advocacy organization dedicated to engendering socioeconomic change on the African continent. Among her other numerous achievements and endeavors, Dr. Oyebode is a human rights activist specializing in women and girls initiatives, co-convener of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, and author of The Stolen Daughters of Chibok. The book is described as a collection of supplemental essays by acclaimed experts, interviews and photographs of many of the families who endured the aftermath of the kidnapping of their daughters. The book humanizes the traumatic effect of the abductions on family members, the community, and the girls themselves. It is also a tribute to the girls and highlights the courage it has taken to cope with the aftermath of their traumatic experience, and it offers hope for the families so they can move forward in their lives. Dr. Oyebode, thank you so much for joining me on Press Conference USA.
Thank you so much, Kim. I'm happy to be here.
Well, first, let's go back to April 14th, 2014. What was the initial reaction to the kidnapping by the families?
Oh, I think initially there was quite a lot of fear. So if you understand that the school in Chibok, it's in the center of the Chibok local government, but what you have is a whole host of communities, of different communities. So girls were coming from different localities to attend that school. So for some of the parents, it took several hours for them to even know anything had happened in the school. But those that were within the vicinity of the school had actually heard some of the explosions, they had heard gunshots. And so some of them had gone to hide because they thought that their community was going to be attacked. So you can imagine when they came out the following morning to see smoke rising away out of the school, because after the girls were abducted, the school buildings were set on fire. And so there was a lot of fear initially, there was shock, but I don't imagine anybody expected that the girls would have been taken away. When the realization came upon them that their daughters had been abducted, they started calling, they were calling the military, they were calling the police. And some of the fathers then gathered and went in the direction of Sambisa Forest, where the trucks that had taken the girls were driving towards.
This sounds like a very harrowing experience, just the terror that these young girls must have been facing. And also a recent report by the human rights organization Amnesty International says Nigerian authorities have not carried out a single credible investigation into the security failures that left the young girls vulnerable to the atrocities committed by Boko Haram and gunmen. So based on your interviews, how was it that 276 girls were able to be abducted from their school?
In fact, that's one of the things that the book talks about, what I call dereliction in the face of terror. If you can imagine that Boko Haram, when the Boko Haram men went into the school, they were not actually looking for girls. They were looking for a block-making machine, and they were looking for food. And when they got there, they couldn't believe it when they found 300 plus girls in the dormitories taking exams a month and a half before in another school not too far away from Chibok in the neighboring state of Yobe. Boko Haram had also gone into the school. They had killed about 59 boys and locked away the girls and told them, go home. School is not a place for girls. So everybody knew, at least in that locality, that there was a challenge with respect to women and girls being gathered in a school. They knew that Boko Haram had an aversion for women going to school. So it was just unbelievable that so many girls could have been gathered in that one place. And when the terrorists realized that there were so many girls, they abandoned the food, they abandoned the block making machine, they sequestered more vehicles, and they piled the girls into that vehicle. Despite all of that, it took them 3 days to get to the outskirts of Sambisa Forest. I mean, as in literally, even though 276 girls were taken at the very beginning, 57 of them managed to jump out of the trucks, hanging onto trees and so on. That was how slowly the trucks were going. I mean, there was a lot of denial and disbelief. It was until the principal of the school came out and said, yes, girls were taken, because there was some argued girls were taken, some argued girls were not taken. Some said the girls had been returned. There was a lot of chaos around it. And it was just, like you said, extremely chaotic and very, very traumatic for all of the people who were involved.
What was the government's initial reaction to the abductions?
Well, there was a lot of general denial, you know, and so the response was really slow. By the time the government responded, the girls had already, 219 girls had already been taken into Sambisa Forest. And those were the girls who remained with Boko Haram for almost a year plus before the first girl actually wandered out, literally. It wasn't even a rescue. The military had found a couple that had escaped Boko Haram, and it turned out that one of them, the girl, was a Chibok girl.
And what motivated you or moved you to want to humanize the story of these girls and their families?
Because I think once we got over the shock and then we realized that girls indeed had been abducted, we couldn't get over the numbers. You know, 219 girls in Boko Haram's captivity. So we started the Bring Back Our Girls movement, which, you know, everybody's now familiar with. And it was a coalition of women groups, especially in Nigeria. And our argument was that, you know, it's not possible that this many girls could just sort of disappear into thin air. But in all of that, there was a lot of denial. There's a lot of disbelief. You know, and there was a general feeling of apathy. And so for me, I thought, I've met the families, I've met mothers, and I couldn't understand why there was this argument, were girls abducted, were girls not abducted. And it was at that point that the Murtala Mohammed Foundation said, why don't we would send in interviewers, a photographer and cinematographer, let's go and interview the families of these girls. Let's actually hear the mothers. I mean, it's not possible to have 219 families who are missing daughters, and we will, you know, not believe them. So it was on that basis. And it was just at that initial stage was to collect the stories and try and understand, you know, the extent of this tragedy. And when we got there, it was incredible. I mean, the stories were incredible. The families were talking about their daughters. They were talking about the circumstances which their daughters were abducted. They talked about their daughters before the abduction. And they talked about their trauma waiting for these girls to be found. And you can imagine this, when we sent the reporters in, this was at the height of the insurgency. I actually went to Chibok on the second anniversary of the kidnappings. I was able to see this burnt out school. It was harrowing for me. And I remember thinking, really, this is an emblem of the worst kind of misogyny that you can imagine. And but at that point also, there was a realization that if we did not humanize these girls, it was very easy for them to disappear as numbers. Because at that time, as much as we were advocating for the girls to be returned, I don't think as many people connected with the traumatic experience for these communities, for these families. So that was why it was important at that time to gather those stories. And then gradually, as we were reading through the stories, transcribing them, became then important that perhaps there was a book in these stories that we could actually use as a memoir and, I suppose, a tribute to these girls and their families, yes. And I think also my view was that because, you know, after a year plus when girls had not returned, I felt perhaps if we collected these stories, then maybe one day those girls would be able to read those stories. And the reason why was also important was in the 90s, when the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda kidnapped girls, it took 14 years for all of the girls to return. The last girl actually returned after 14 years. So we knew at some point that the wait was going to be long for these girls. Today, we're 9 years after Chibok, and we still have 92 girls still waiting to be rescued or to be found.
Yes, that is a very, very sad. And when it first happened, this story made international headlines. And then over time, of course, it seemed to fade. So it's very important that you actually went out, you talked to the families to find out how they coped with this situation. So what are some of the things that you found out in talking to the families? How were they coping with this?
I think that one of the things that has stood out is that within that period, many parents have actually died. Some of them from, I suppose, illnesses that you can associate with deep trauma. Some have had heart attacks, some have had strokes. So many parents have died, let me just put it that way. And unfortunately, even with families, so in about a year ago, a girl returned in her family. So there are four families who lost two daughters each, but there's only one family who've actually recovered two of their daughters, and the father died, I would say, a year after the second daughter returned. You can imagine that kind of devastation for the families. The trauma has been challenging for a lot of the families, but there's also a certain kind of strength that you see, this determination to go on. And in that determination, it's always they say that it doesn't matter, because there are those who argue that the girls have changed, that the girls have been married off to terrorists and the girls have had children with terrorists. So in other words, you know, perhaps there's no reason why they should be found. And the families insist that they want their daughters back. It doesn't matter whether they've been married. It doesn't matter how many children they'll come back to. It doesn't matter whether they've, you know, injured in the conflict. So we've had a girl who returned after her leg was amputated. So there's so many different strands. So there's the grief, there's the resilience, there's the determination, you know, there's the trauma. But the one thing I can say is the refusal to be victims. And I think you can see that in the stories when they talk about their daughters, they talk about the lives that they led with their daughters before the abduction. Chibok is a very small community of women. So it's a mixed community, by the way, of Christians and Muslims. And one of the things that they were always, that was clear, was this quest for education for their daughters. You could read in the book about the sacrifices that the families had to make, that the sacrifices the girls had to make for them to get an education.
Yes, that's a very good point, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. For now, let's take a quick break, and when we return, we'll talk more on overcoming the trauma of being kidnapped and forced into marriage, as what happened to the Chibok schoolgirls 9 years ago.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Dr. Aisha Mohammed Oyebode, CEO of Murtala Mohammed Foundation. She's a human rights activist and author of The Stolen Daughters of Chibok. I'm Kim Lewis, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download at voanews.com/PCUSA. And be sure to tune into our other current affairs programs, Encounter and Issues in the News. You can download the podcast at voa.com/encounter and voanews.com/Issues in the News. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Now back to our discussion with Dr. Aisha Mohammed Oyebode on the aftermath of the schoolgirl's kidnapping. Dr. Oyebode, there are reports, and I think you touched on this before the break, that some of the abducted girls wanted to return to their captors. So how were these cases dealt with, and where are these girls now?
Okay, so what has generally happened, and this is actually not just limited to the Chibok girls, there have been situations, and it's one of the things that we talk about when we talk about structural violence and also Chibok being a metaphor for a larger problem within the society, which is that when you have societies where sexual violence is, you know, you would call it sanctioned across board, the idea of forced marriage is not new to the Chibok girls. You have issues of stigma. You have what we call systemic oppression of women and girls. It does sometimes change the societal balance. So you've actually had situations where women and girls who have been abducted have chosen to go back to their captors. Some of the justification around it could be a variation of Stockholm syndrome. For some, though, is that they actually feel that their life, in a way, they had more agency with their captors than they did. But the other reverse side of it is, though, we've also had girls who have refused to come back because they're afraid of how society will view them. One of the things that Boko Haram and a lot of these groups do as soon as they abduct women and girls is to break them. So what they do is that they sexually assault them, they rape them. So many of them very quickly become emotionally traumatized and they cannot imagine themselves coming back to their home communities. So with regards to the Chibok girl, in my essay, I talk about a girl called Saraya Paul. And the title around that is -1, because in May 2017, when 83 girls were negotiated for, we were expecting 83 girls, but only 82 girls were returned. And we say only, I mean, 82 out of 83 is a large number, but we had that one girl who refused to come back because she was afraid of the stigma and how society would respond to her. So it's very complex, very, very complex situation. And part of the problem also is that another tool that Boko Haram uses, which they've learned from other groups that are operating in conflict, is this idea of legitimizing the rape and the sexual violence under a marriage. Now, what the international community has realized, especially the international courts that dealt with the conflict in Sierra Leone between 2002 and 2008, is that forced marriage is actually a worse situation than just sexual assault and sexual violence, because they then say that the terrorist has now left an imprint on the girls. So in reality, what then tends to happen is that many more of these girls, even when there's an opportunity for them to escape, to leave or to be rescued, they do not want to come back. So as a result of that, actually, the International UN Court in Sierra Leone has declared forced marriage in conflict as a crime against humanity.
Yes, and it really is. I'm glad you brought up the stigma attached to that, because my understanding is that some of these girls came back with children and with fathers unknown to them. So there's the extra burden of not only caring for a child, but the social stigma and rejection by society. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, so there's the social stigma, there's the children, and then some of them have had to go through multiple marriages. So you'll have one girl who's been in captivity for 8 years and she's been married 3 times, which is just as even more traumatic. Dealing with it has been challenging. I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of the Chibok community, and that tends to happen in smaller communities like Chibok, most of the families are willing to embrace and accept these children. But the larger communities, there's a lot of stigma. And even now, even within the Chibok community, the longer some girls have stayed in Boko Haram captivity, the more the parents are beginning to feel the burden of this stigma, because there's a view that their daughters have chosen to remain with their captors. We know that that's not true, but that is the way some members of society have chosen to interpret it. Part of it, I think, is way of being able to deal with it, the emotional trauma for those who within the larger community is to say, well, you know, if this was to happen to me, maybe my own child will return much earlier. So maybe those who have returned later have chosen to stay, but that's not the case. So one of the things that the government has attempted to do is to try and return as many of the girls, at least within the Chibok community, that have been abducted back to school. They're trying to provide them with psychosocial support, but it's a very large problem that I'm not even sure we're clear of the extent of it and what it's going to take to be able to deal with it. And from the perspective of, you know, an organization like ours that works with women and girls that are in this kind of conflict, it's just, like I keep saying, a metaphor. It shows that women are at risk, usually, of more violence. They're the ones who are often neglected. They're the ones who are often violated. And it has to do first with their gender. And of course, there's the issue of social status. So I suppose perhaps the outcry now, beyond asking for the girls to be returned, is that policy reforms that will support gender equality and, you know, supporting women, you know, who have just come back from these kind of situations.
Yes. And also you talk about courage in your book and how it took, you know, courage for these young girls who have really now, after years, are young women now, and also courage on the part of their parents. So how do you instill courage in a young girl so that she does overcome this and becomes a very productive, optimistic, happy person?
Okay, so one thing that we have seen that is clear is actually giving them an opportunity to adjust back to the real life, back to the society, but also a way that the years away, right, do not become a burden. So let me put that in a different context. One of the things the Murtala Mohammed Foundation is trying to make sure the government does, which the government, by the way, is already doing, is to ensure that all of these girls who are interested in getting an education are given that opportunity. What an education does is allows them to bridge that gap. So even though years have been wasted, there are girls who have returned 3, 4, 5 years after being abducted. Once they are put back in a school situation, it allows them to, I suppose, bridge a gap, really, to feel that they've been able to, those years that they lost, they've been able to, in an interesting way, recoup them. And I'll give you an example. The family that I talked about earlier, where 2 girls were missing, one was found in 2016. She was put back in university. She's actually now going to graduate this year as a computer scientist. Her sister, who just returned a year later, has been married 3 times. She's got 3, come back with 3 children and no education. So what we are now trying to say is, okay, is there any way that can be remedied? So education is definitely one answer to that. The other one, we need to be able to refocus and to be able to review our societal approach to situations where women and girls have come back from these kind of situations. So, for example, if you socio-cultural framework needs to be revisited, you know, even within our societies generally, we have very strong views about stigma, social contamination and contagion. So which means that people who come from a traumatic situation, we still find it difficult to integrate them back into society. We need to revisit, we need to review that. We need to look at even our laws that we apply to these kind of situations. I think you mentioned at the beginning when you said Amnesty International has noted that the Nigerian government has not investigated clearly this kind of situations. Yes, in real terms, nobody has been, well, we've had a few trials, but we have not still been able to say that these are the people who were actually responsible for these abductions. Nobody has been made to pay a price. And in fact, since Chibok, a UN report that was released last year has shown that over another 1,500 women, girls, and even children have been abducted from different schools within northern Nigeria. So there's so many issues that we need to resolve.
You brought up some really good points, and especially considering that there's been no accountability. No one is having to pay for these horrific, traumatic actions. And looking at this from your work that you are doing and then your book, what are some of the biggest lessons that you want the world to know? Talking with the parents and families of the abducted girls and your work as a human rights activist.
I think the first thing is we really need to develop a policy for bringing women and girls back safely from abduction. I think it sounds really simple. I actually think that that's the first thing we really need to think about. And part of it then means trying to see how do we then restore equilibrium back to communities like Chibok after these girls have been returned. And of course, you know, to Nigeria within the larger society. I think supporting policy reforms that support gender equality and the empowerment of women is critical. I think education, I've talked about it before, I cannot say it enough. Safety in our schools must be paramount, but there has to be an element of accountability when these kind of situations happen. When there's no accountability, there's a lot of impunity. And there's a view that, you know what, women and girls are soft and easy targets. If we take them, nobody is going to make us accountable. So I say those are the kind of lessons that we need to learn. The other lesson that I think is also important is to catalog stories after women and girls have returned. I remember asking many of the girls when they did return, did you know that we were looking for you? Because I just couldn't imagine a situation where being in captivity for so long and not even knowing that the world was looking for them. Some were aware, but the majority of them were not. And what they would say was that because it was a conflict and there were times when there would be air raids and when their camps were being bombed, we say to them, well, you see, they're also trying to kill you. Nobody is looking for you. And then I would say to them, but we do have stories. We have interviews with your parents when you were away. Would you like me to read what your mother said about you when you were away? And it was at that point that they then began to realize actually that, you know, we were looking for them. The whole world was looking for them. I don't think we're doing enough also to really understand, you know, that journey. And I think that's another important issue. A lot of psychosocial support is critical, you know, for the women and girls. But more importantly, from the Chibok abductions, I think community resilience is critical. It's one of the strands that we see with Chibok that we don't see with some of the other communities. And it's something that is important to build when these kind of situations happen.
Dr. Oyebode, I wish we could talk more on this subject, and I'm sure our audience is very intrigued by the abduction of 276 schoolgirls from Chibok, Nigeria, and how these courageous girls are thriving in the aftermath. Sadly, not all are free, but human rights activists such as Dr. Oyebode are not giving up on seeing that they are returned to their homes. Again, my guest is Dr. Aisha Mohammed Oyebode, CEO of Murtala Mohammed Foundation. She's a human rights activist, and she's author of The Stolen Daughters of Chibok, a collection of essays, interviews, and photographs from the families and the communities of the Chibok schoolgirls.
Thank you very much, Kim. Thank you.
Thank you. And Press Conference USA was produced in Washington. I'm Kim Lewis. Join us next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.